Welcome to the Royal Diaries, Unlocking History. My name is Julia.
My name is Felicia. We are sisters who love books, history, and talking about them both.
We're doing a deep dive into the Royal Diaries series.
Come with us as we learn about the girls who became women that shaped history.
Catherine, The Great Journey, Russia, 1743, by Christiana Gregory. Summary reads, the diary of Princess Sophie, later named Catherine, from 1743 until 1746, when at the age 15 she is married to her second cousin Peter, Grand Duke of Russia, who will one day be emperor, includes historical notes on her later life. We've come to the end of
our journey.
I literally have our journey!
Because it's Catherine's great journey, and we're coming to the end of our great journey.
You're not even to stop that.
Okay.
See, personally, I was thinking about all like the really bad CSI Miami. The guy got blinded by acid. I guess he didn't see that one coming.
Oh, yeah!
Let's just go and like jump right into it. What did you think of the book?
So remember how we were saying, blah, 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 we're at the end, and we haven't read these ones, etc.?
Yeah.
I read this one in university because I was part of a Russian history class, and I needed to come up with another source for a paper about Catherine the Great.
Oh, my God.
So I literally Googled around books about Catherine the Great. This bad boy showed up, and I remembered how there were historical notes at the end. So I thought, even if I tangentially reference it, it's still in my work cited in that paper, Catherine the Great Journey.
Oh my God.
So I did read this one in like my first year of university, but I liked it, but I don't really strongly remember it.
What did you think about it this time?
I enjoyed it. It's funny because there's a lot of parallels between this one and the Marie Antoinette one.
Yeah.
Preparing for a marriage and feeling underprepared, except for Marie Antoinette has a nicer mom. This lady is not a nice mom.
Not at all. Like,
she can join the
terrible parent,
club that we have established. I don't know. I enjoyed this one. I liked it, even though, you know, we've had complaints about why isn't it leading up to like in a wedding or a this or a this. Well, it ends and it's the epilogue kicks off on their wedding sort of thing. So as a reader, you do get that feeling of, okay, we've built towards
a thing.
This. And I appreciated her characterization. I feel like they did a good job of showing that push-pull of what do you have to sacrifice as the individual.
Mm-hmm.
To step into a role and stuff like that.
Christiana Gregory wrote the Cleopatra book, and she also wrote Eleanor of Aquitaine, and she wrote this one. I wouldn't say she's the strongest, but I think of one who's done more than one book, she's one of the strongest.
She writes cuspy teen girls very, very well.
Very, very well.
I appreciate, too, it's like the time and attention that's into emphasizing the opulence of the court.
Mm-hmm.
I also really like how there was her and Peter trying to have some sort of an understanding or a friendship and how that sort of goes back and forth thing. And with the mom, especially, I don't like it when in a book, someone does the one bad action or the one nice thing and it's one and done.
Yeah.
And then the author is basically saying, you should know about this character now because they had this one scene.
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciate how there was consistency there.
I think one of the things I like about Gregory's writing is that it actually reads like a diary.
Mm-hmm.
I still am not over. Lawrence Yip did write one of the better books in the series, but it did not have a strong opening couple of lines with Lady of Chiaoku. But I think that with this book, there was strong characterization, there was strong plotting, and I think that it felt very natural, too, as well.
Even the time jumps, they made sense.
Yeah. It wasn't like eye contact with somebody, and now I couldn't write for like a year.
What? Whereas this is like legitimately a maid has stolen things around our house, and she stole the diary.
Exactly.
Or the hat box that the diary was in, and like she clearly read it. That is a very plausible thing.
Yeah, and with the diary being stolen, too, I'm like, this is like a really great character moment, too, which might, you know, explain why Catherine is the way that Sophie is the way that she is, you know?
Yeah.
So this is the first time I had to read it. Basically, like, also getting to, like, the politics of her name change, too, as well.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of stuff with Catherine the Great where it's you just always end up asking, why?
Yeah.
How did Sophie, a German princess from a minor family, end up being, you know, empress of all the Russians?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't tell you exactly that part of the story, but it's taking you on that journey.
Yes, of transformation. So,
exactly. Like a beautiful butterfly. Or is she?
Dun, dun, dun.
I don't know why I went like with the whole like dun, dun, dun ominous tone all of a sudden, because like it's really not. But anyways, let's just jump into it. The thing about Catherine the Great is that she has recently re-entered the cultural moment via The Great, the Hulu series, which I've been seeing, but you have.
Yes, I have.
Give me like a brief thought on it.
Like, it's so inaccurate, it hurts. Mm. If you care one iota about historical accuracy, don't watch this show.
Is it worse than The Tudors?
No, this one knows that it's being historically inaccurate. It even says the tagline, a mostly untrue history. Mm. So they know that they've messed around with who's who, actually. So, for example, Peter Nicholas Holt, who she's with, is actually the son of Peter the Great.
Yeah.
And his Aunt Elizabeth is just this wacky, tabacky kind of lady who wants to hang out with butterflies. But it's all about the weird machinations of court life and intrigue. And she wants to be an enlightened leader and all this other stuff. But she's confronted with the very real reality of you got to get your hands dirty, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. The biggest critique I have about that is because they cast Nicholas Holt as Peter, who she eventually will overthrow in a coup, et cetera, et cetera, and he will be killed. Nicholas Holt's too charming.
Mm-hmm.
He's too charming to be this misanthrope type of child person. Instead, they're just like making him a hot sex deviant, which I'm not complaining about, but I'm just thinking, you've painted yourselves into a corner. If I was a producer, I'd be like, don't cast Nick. You can't kill him. It's like where the story has to go. That push-pull. Now it's like, oh, but we love each other, but we're like against each other.
No.
What is happening here? The problem is that they've sidelined other supporting characters who actually make her coup happen, because Nicholas and Elle are both scenery chewers. So everybody else
doesn't matter.
They're trying their best to be dynamic and engaging, but they just get steamrolled over.
Well,
so yeah.
Well, I'm glad I've not watched The Great. I don't know if I'm going to. There's also the recent series, Ekaterina, which is great if you haven't seen it.
Probably more accurate.
A little bit more accurate. Also, great costumes. The acting is pretty freaking fabulous. I mean, I don't speak Russian, but it sounds all good to me, you know?
Yeah, no, and I feel like they probably understand it.
Yeah, they do. And she's also, like, sort of a character in Alexandra Sokurov's 2002 masterpiece, Russian Ark, which, if you haven't seen it, definitely go and watch that movie. It's weird, but it's amazing.
It's like a Russian art film. What are you expecting?
Yeah, but it's a Russian art film about art and, like, time. And how do we make memory and meaning, Felicia?
So basically, anyone who's into all the weird meta-narrative conversations we've had throughout this podcast, if you're into those,
watch Russian Ark.
Watch Russian Ark.
Yeah. Anyways, but today we're doing sort of a biography, sort of an overview of Russian history and Russianness. We're trying to go and answer a question as how did somebody so random, who had no real claim to the Russian throne, usher in essentially the golden age for Russia?
Yeah.
But to do that, we need to ask some additional questions and answer them. So who was she? Where did she come from? She was born on the 2nd of May, 1729, or on the 21st of April, 1729, if you're using the old-style calendar, in Stettin, Pomerania, Prussia, which is now Szczecin, Poland. As always, fam. Unlike Felicia, who's like, I pronounced a single word wrong. I must edit it in. Me, I'm like, oh, let's go. And now we're going to try. And if we get it wrong,
sorry, Russians.
We're just going to deal with it. Her name at birth was Princess Sophie Frederique Auguste von Anhalt-Zerbst-Dornberg. Her early childhood was mostly uneventful. She was primarily raised and educated by French governesses, as was the style at the time. Her dad was Christian Auguste, Prince of Anhalt-Zerbst, who ruled over Anhalt-Zerbst and was made, towards the end of his life, General Field Marshal by Frederick the Great. And yes, that Frederick is the fun throwback to Marie Antoinette.
Mm-hmm.
There are going to be a couple of very familiar names in this episode. Her dad had more ambition than his role. He wanted to become Duke of Courland and Semigalia, which was part of Poland at the time, but that ambition didn't really go anywhere. Her dad, he aspired to great heights, and he sort of got there. I mean, he was made Grand Field Marshal of the Prussian Army, but he was never really satisfied, and also he reached that rank, and he was dead 2 years later.
Yeah, kind of a lousy promotion.
Yeah. He didn't die like that. He just died of, like, I think it wasn't smallpox, but it was, like, some sort of, like, rich person, except not, like, no, like, a noble disease.
A noble disease.
Yeah. Yeah. And her mother was Johanna Elizabeth of Holstein of Gotterup. And here's where things go and get a little bit more interesting.
It's not Gillian Anderson.
It's not Gillian Anderson, who does play a mom really good on Sex Education, but apparently not on The Great.
She plays Joanna very accurately in terms of her being not a nice mom, but very inaccurately where she's trying to seduce Nicholas Holt.
I mean, but can you blame her, though?
No.
Okay, Nicholas Holt is the only hot alien-looking man that is allowed to exist in the universe. Although Sophie was born a princess, her family had very little money. Her mobility was supported mostly by her mother's wealthy relatives, who were both nobles, and they had royal relations. Her mother's brother became the heir to the Swedish throne after her second cousin, Peter III, converted to Orthodoxy. There were more than 300 sovereign entities of the Holy Roman Empire, many of them quite small with limited power. Because remember, like, you have the Holy Roman Empire and you have Austria, the big thing. Mm-hmm. But then you have all, like, those small little protectorates because the Holy Roman Empire wanted to pretend it was, like, a country, but it really was just, like, a bunch of piecemeal things, like, disguised in a trench coat pretending it was a big country.
Yes.
We're seeing some of the result of that. So the state of affairs made for a highly competitive political system as the various princely families fought for advantage over each other, often via political marriages. For the smaller families, an advantageous marriage was one of the best means of advancing their interests. Sophie was groomed throughout her childhood to be the wife of a powerful ruler in order to improve the position of the reigning House of Anhalt. Besides her native German, Sophie became fluent in French, which was at that point the lingua franca of the European elites. And this young Sophie was also received education of an 18th century German princess, with a concentration upon learning the etiquette expected of a lady, more French, and Lutheran theology. So,
not that hot.
Not that great. So the real question now is, now knowing that she has to go and make a match, how the hell did she end up marrying Peter III? And who was this dude? And why are Nicholas Holt's eyes so blue?
I don't know. But it is weird when you think about it.
Who? Exactly.
Marrying who?
But then it all makes sense.
Mm.
Okay, so the future Peter III was born Carl Peter Ulrich in 1728 in Kiel, Germany. His mother was the daughter of Russia's Peter the Great, and his father was the nephew of Sweden's Charles XII. So Peter seemed destined to inherit the throne of Sweden at this point, not Russia, and he was also brought up as a Lutheran. So he was a middling student and was weak-willed, but he wasn't actually stupid. Like, he wasn't a dummy. He just was not interested in school.
I mean, why would he be?
Yeah, and his intense dislike for traditional learning was equally balanced with a passion for all things military. He wanted to become a great military leader, and he later emulated Frederick the Great of Prussia. Which makes sense, you know, like, he's Prussian.
Well, yeah, and I mean, it makes sense, too, that, like, you know, he's like his Iron Man or something.
Exactly.
I just want to be like you, Mr. Stark.
By age 11, Peter had been orphaned, however.
Wow.
And a few years later, his future plans were upended when his childish maternal aunt, Russian Empress Elizabeth, chose him as her successor. He was moved to Russia's then capital, St. Petersburg, where he took the name Peter, or Pyotr, and was forced to give up his Lutheran faith, and he had to join the Russian Orthodox Church. A brief side note, we're going to go and get into what, like, I'm terming as the Russian succession clown car. Cue honking noises.
Honka, honka.
Honka, honka. Empress Elizabeth quickly set to work finding her new heir a suitable wife, which is when Sophie comes into the picture and her stage right. In early 1744, when she was only 14, Sophie and her mother traveled to Russia, as we well know. The bright, pretty, vivacious teen quickly charmed both the Empress and the Russian people. But her second cousin Peter was not as enamored as they all were. The two teens had briefly met several years earlier and had taken an almost dislike to each other. The main thing is that they were just such polar opposites in terms of temperament and interest. She liked to read, and she wanted to have a more robust education. He was not interested in it at all. She wasn't against hunting or riding or shooting it or anything, but she's like, it's just like something that you do. For him,
that was like his entire existence.
Exactly. It was his identity. Also, this is where bad parenting slash, you know, being an orphan and being in limbo. Peter had a problem with alcohol from a young age.
Mm.
Like, they met when he was 11 and she was 10, roughly. And she already knew, like, he's, like, an alcoholic. Ooh, they didn't even have a word for alcoholic. And she was like, this is a problem.
I mean, he's still developing.
Exactly.
We all know about the ravages of alcohol on an adult, fully, quote-unquote, formed mind. Can you imagine? You're going through puberty like that.
Or about to, not even. He's prepubescent at that point.
Yeah, that's pretty bad.
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Despite this and Sophie's father's misgivings, a marriage was quickly arranged. Like Peter, Sophie took on a new religion and a new name, Catherine Ekaterina, and the couple wed in August 1745. Catherine was 16 and Peter was 17. While many modern historians have presented a more favorable view of Peter, it is Catherine's depiction of him that prevails. Her letters and memoirs are filled with tales of his boorish, drunken, and frequently cruel behavior. And I'm not going to go and give, like, one of her examples because it's actually, like, really exciting, but it involves animal cruelty. So I'm like, we don't need this in our lives.
I mean, in The Great, he gives her a present of a bear and then he kills the bear in front of her.
Yeah, like, it's
like,
not
along those lines.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So he abandoned her on their wedding night to go and party with his friends, and things pretty much were in a nosedive at that point. An increasingly unhappy Catherine turned to reading, consuming books by Enlightenment authors like Voltaire. Unlike Peter, who remained steadfastly true to his non-Russian roots, she relished in the language and the religion of her adopted homeland, quickly becoming fluent in Russian. Peter, meanwhile, spent his time with soldiers, both told and real, and forming guards unions that he ceaselessly trained. Unsurprisingly, Peter and Catherine found solace in the arms of others. Catherine would later imply in her memoirs that the couple's son, Paul, was fathered not by Peter, but by Catherine's first lover, Sergei Saltykov. But the thing is, though, Paul still had a very strong resemblance to Peter, which made a lot of people think that he was still his dad, fundamentally.
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't know. And I don't really think it matters at this point.
No, not really.
No. And despite having his own mistress, Peter was enraged by rumors that the couple's second child, a short-lived daughter named Anna, was not his. Catherine was also devastated when Elizabeth took control of Paul's upbringing, allowing Catherine only brief and frequent contact with her son. So we do not have a really great start for Catherine in terms of showing up in Russia. So the next question is, how did she end up on the throne, though? So, by the late 1750s, Elizabeth's health had begun to decline. Though it was clear that her reign would soon end, she did little to prepare her heir, seemingly fearful of giving him a role in affairs of state. Which, you know, fair enough, at the same time, like, he's your heir. You need to prepare him?
Yeah, but I feel like, thought it was also very interesting how she's 35 in this book when they're, you know, 15, 16. Mm-hmm. And they're essentially like, we're gonna not be in charge for a long ass time.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably not.
Yeah. But the thing is, so in January 1762, Elizabeth died, placing a 33-year-old Peter on the throne, and Catherine was his empress consort.
Can you imagine, like, not having any sort of training, job, anything?
Whatever. Oh, yeah, like, there's no onboarding.
They're like, welcome. Well, I feel like it's like when you graduate school, they're like, welcome to the real world. Get a job.
Fuck.
You need 15 years of social media experience.
Yeah, and it's like, and you can go and get paid $11 an hour.
Yeah.
Or you can go and have a free internship. Robert K. Massey writes in Catherine the Great, Portrait of a Woman, from the beginning of her husband's reign, her position was one of isolation and humiliation. It was obvious to her that Peter's hostility had evolved to a determination to end their marriage and remove her from public life.
Uh-oh.
Like, they've been married for about 16 years, because if he was 17 when they got married, he was 34 for 16 years.
Yeah.
And, like, things never got good. Never good. They never liked each other.
Well, and now there's no one around to say, like, you can't get rid of your wife.
Exactly.
He's the absolute ruler.
Exactly. But it's not even just that he's being a dick to his wife. Peter also made some changes immediately. Despite Prussia being Russia's longtime enemy, he withdrew from the Seven Years' War and threw his support behind Frederick the Great. Strike number one. He even dressed Russian troops in Prussian blue and began military reforms based on the Prussian model, deeply angering many army officers. I will just say, this is not inherently a bad idea, because Frederick the Great was, like, slapping ass, like, no matter what.
Yeah, but I wouldn't dress them in the same, I mean, unless it was, like, a tactical thing, or, like, if we dress up like the enemy, we go to attack the enemy, they'll be like, friendly fire! And we're like, yeah, friendly fire, not Russians dressed as Prussians shooting at you.
I don't think Peter was that sophisticated.
No, he was not.
No. His mistrust of the Russian Orthodox Church led to the passage of a new law that promised religious freedom for Russians, which the church saw as another slap in the face. He never really liked being Russian Orthodox. He wanted to be Lutheran. If he had been made King of Sweden,
he would have been okay.
He would have been fine. He would have crushed it, probably, at being Queen. King of Sweden!
Yeah, we already have one of those Kings of Sweden.
Oh, yeah. He did make the killing of serfs, peasants who were legally owned by their wealthy masters. He made killing them illegal.
Oh, that's nice. Kill the property that you own.
And he also outlawed Russia's notorious secret police.
Oh, I do know these people. The Oprichnia.
Yes.
Created by Ivan the Terrible.
Yes. Now, most of these things sound like bad ideas, and they were. I mean, just obviously to go and be clear that banning serfs being killed is a capital G great idea. But these groups, the military, the church, and the nobility, were essential to maintain power in the empire. Catherine had been cultivating relationships with these groups ever since she showed up.
And it's really funny, though, because in the TV show, it's she's the one busting in and being like, I'm breaking down all this shit. And he's the one who's like, no, 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 we maintain this shit because this is what keeps us afloat.
Yeah. Despite not having the formal education for leadership, she had the ambition and had been, as mentioned, expanding her knowledge. On the night of July 8th, 1762, Catherine got word that one of her co-conspirators in the plot had been arrested. And what was this plot? It was to go and overthrow her husband. The following day, she raced to gain the support of the most powerful military regiment in Russia. With their backing, she was ordained by the church. Catherine then ordered the arrest and forced abdication of her husband. The bloodless shift in power was so easily accomplished that Frederick the Great of Prussia, his hero, later observed, Peter allowed himself to be dethroned like a child being sent to bed.
This is basically like Tony Stark, way to go, Peter Parker. And Peter's like, no!
Peter's reign lasted just 6 months. It seemed like the coup had been achieved without a drop of blood being shed. After he was forced to abdicate, Peter was exiled to a location outside of St. Petersburg. 8 days later, he would be declared dead. Yep. The official cause of death was announced as severe hemorrhoids and an epoxy stroke, although it is widely believed that he died at the hands of Alexei Orlov, brother of Grigory Orlov, who was Catherine's lover at the time.
See, Orlov in The Great is kind of not a get-your-hands-dirty kind of guy.
See, and I feel like if they had Nicholas Holt playing him...
Yes! Yes!
You know what they gotta do? You know what they should have done? They should have gone and had Nicholas Holt play every single male character on that show, and no questions asked.
I mean, it would have been deeply interesting. He does play his own body double, though.
I love that. I love that for me.
Yeah.
So whether or not Catherine had a hand in Peter's death is still up for historical debate. But the death of Peter certainly marred the early years of Catherine's rule. And obviously the fact that people are still like, did she kill him? I mean, it continues on, right?
Cute but psycho. Like, what are we going to do about that?
But anyways, on the 22nd of September 1762, at the Assumption Cathedral in Moscow, Catherine was crowned and became Catherine II, by the grace of God, Empress and Autocrat of all the Russians at Moscow, Kiev, Vladimir, Novgorod, Tsarina of Kazan, Tsarina of Achishan, Tsarina of Siberia, Lady of Pleskov, and Grand Duchess of Smolensk, Duchess of Estonia, Livland, Tsarelian, Tver, Yugoria, Permia, Vitaka, and Bulgaria, and others, Lady and Grand Duchess of Novgorod in the Netherlands of Chernigov, Rezin, Rosolov, Yaroslav, Belorussia, Eudora, Obdoria, Kondinia, and the ruler of the entire North region, and Lady of the Uresh, the Caledonian, of the Gorishian Tsars, and of the Kabardinian lands, and of the Cherkessian and Gorsian princes, and the Lady of the Manor, and sovereign of many others.
Not too shabby.
I mean, not as great as Franz Joseph. I would be intimidated if I got that on a forwarding address, you know?
Or on your business card.
Oh, yeah. So now this leads us to ask, what kind of ruler is she and why was she so great? Or was she so great?
Yeah, what's all the hype about?
Yes. Like, when we talk about Catherine the Great, we need to keep in mind of her two greatest influences, fundamentally. The Enlightenment and Peter the Great. I can't go and hit everything that happened during her reign, but I want to go and give a pretty comprehensive overview. And I do want us to go, and people are like, why are we telling you my opinion of the Great? You can't understand why Catherine did what she did without knowing what Peter the Great started.
Well, also, because it's she and Peter who are given the titles the Great, so what did they do?
Yeah. Now, she's still derided in both her day and in modern times as a hypocritical warmonger with an unnatural sexual appetite. Catherine was a woman of contradiction whose brazen exploits have long overshadowed the accomplishments that won her the great moniker in the first place. I'm not going to go and talk too much about her personal life. She had a lot of men who she really liked, had a lot of fun with. Not that those things aren't important, because of course, oh my god, that's so much fun. But I think that there are enough people, tee hee hee, someone had sex. I'm like, I don't need to talk about that. Someone else can go and do that for me.
If we're only going to talk about a person and reduce them only to their relationship status, I feel like that's only for Henry VIII.
Exactly.
Like, he deserves to only be reduced to his relationship status.
Not Catherine the Great. Let's talk about the other great, Peter the Great. I'm not going to go into his bio. We're just going to go in broad sketches of who he was. So he was determined to reform the domestic structure of Russia. He had a simple desire to push Russia, willingly or otherwise, into the modern era as existed at that point. While his military reforms were ongoing, he reformed the church, education, and areas of Russia's economy. Before Peter I, Russia was not very connected with Europe, nor did it have a navy that could assert any authority on its sea borders. One of the things is that when we think about Russia, is that at that point, they've been mostly moving eastwards. They were not really looking westwards at that point. Just like as like a brief side note, always go and talk about like colonialism, but we never really go and talk about how Russia was just like all this land, so empty. And then all the indigenous people are like, hi, we're here. It's like all this land, so empty. You know, I kind of wish we talked about that.
Well, because it was really their land in their opinion. So exactly. They're just like, we're just going to keep on walking through. It's my backyard, a bajillion miles long.
Exactly. And I think like also too is that because they never had to do meaningful like sea crossing or exploration, I think like that also might be part of it. Like there's a lot of writing about like Russia, its colonization within its own borders, quote unquote.
Well, Russia, Canada, the US, it's very much like a, why would we have to go anywhere? We have everything here.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That all being said, although Russia was huge, it would lag behind in its ships at the time when European powers such as England and the Dutch were exploring and colonizing the globe. With the goal of learning from European nations' success, Peter the Great spent time during 1697 and 1698 traveling around Europe on a grand embassy. Do you remember what the grand embassy was?
He was basically trying to be quote-unquote in disguise and travel around, and he's basically like Ariel when she gets her legs and she's discovering the human world.
Pretty much.
Except just the way that Ariel stands out a lot, Peter did the same because he was really friggin' tall.
Yep.
And he didn't know how to do subtle.
Yeah.
So everybody essentially was just like, just play along. We know it's Peter. We're not going to call him Peter. You know, he's got this whole I'm in disguise thing.
Yeah.
Just roll with it.
And also, too, like, it was him and about 250 nobles and his entourage.
Yeah, like so low-key, so low-key.
Exactly. The thing is, like, there were two main goals with this trip. He wanted to learn about Europe, and he wanted to gain allies against the Ottoman Empire, which at that point was pushing along the southern borders. And also, they were really good friends with the Polish-Lithuania Commonwealth, which was not a really good look in Peter's eyes. The latter project failed. Everybody was caught up in the War of the Spanish Succession at that point. But he absolutely crushed it with the former. Up to the point where he worked in a shipyard owned by the Dutch East India Company for 4 months so he could learn how to strengthen Russia's navy. Like, it's pretty much like undercover bosses.
I know. I was just going to say, I love the story of someone who's like, I'm the president of the bank, but I started as a teller and I worked my way up through every single position, so I know what it's like. I approve of that.
Yeah. Well, in the Netherlands, he also visited with families who had massive art and coin collections from Dutch experts. Craftsmen and artists, Peter learned how to draw teeth, catch butterflies, and paint seascapes. In England, he also engaged in painting and navy-related activities, and he also visited Manchester in order to learn the techniques of city building that he would later use to great effect in St. Petersburg. In 1698, Peter sent a delegation to Malta to observe the training and abilities of the Knights of Malta and their fleet. One of the things, like, you had to go and appreciate about Peter, he's like, I don't know things. I'm going to go to the best and learn from them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a quality I appreciate.
Yeah.
Peter's visits to the West impress upon him the notion that European customs were, in several respects, superior to Russian traditions. Unlike most of his predecessors and successors, he attempted to follow Western European traditions, fashions, and tastes. One of the most famous examples is his beard tax. Mm. Do you know what the beard tax is?
You have to cut your beard off or we're going to charge you.
Yeah. And it also was a whole thing because the Russian Orthodox Church is like, you have to have a beard.
Yeah, because it was like a symbol of piety and also Russianness. There's a great political cartoon of Peter with like a pair of scissors just chopping off the boyars' beards.
Pretty much.
The noble beards. Yeah.
He was smart and he's like, well, if you all don't want to do it, then you have to pay me money. So then he made money
off. So it's a win-win either way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
French was also made the official court language. Basically, if it was Western European, it was good. And if it was Slavic, Russian, it was bad. He also made several administrative changes. One of his major goals was reducing the influence of the boyars, who stressed Slavic supremacy and opposed European influence. While their clout had been declining since the reign of Ivan the Terrible, the Boyar Duma, an advisory council to the Tsar, still wielded considerable political power. Peter saw them as backwards and as obstacles standing in the way of his plans for Europeanization and reform. He specifically targeted boyars with numerous taxes and obligatory services. Pretty much if he could find a reason to go and tax you, he taxed you. If he found a thing that he needed you to do, he made you do it. Prior to Peter's rule, Russia's administrative system was relatively antiquated compared to many of Western European nations. The state was divided into the uyezds, which mostly consisted of cities and their immediate surrounding areas. In 1708, Peter abolished these old national subdivisions and established in their place 8 governorates. In 1711, a new state body was established, the Governing Senate. All its members were appointed by the Tsar from among his own associates, and it originally consisted of 10 people. All appointments and resignations of senators occurred by personal imperial decrees. The Senate did not interrupt the activities and was the permanent operating state body. Another decree in 1713 established the Landrats, from the German word for national council, in each of the governorates, staffed by between 8 and 12 professional civil servants who assisted a royally appointed governor. In 1719, after the establishment of government departments known as the Collegia, Peter remade Russia's administrative divisions once more. The new provinces were modeled on the Swedish system, in which larger, more politically important areas received more political autonomy, while smaller, more rural areas were controlled more directly by the state. Peter's distrust by the elitist and anti-reformist boyars culminated in 1722 with the creation of the Table of Ranks, a formal list of ranks in the Russian military, government, and royal court. The Table of Ranks established a complex system of titles, honorifics, each classified by a number denoting a specific level of service or loyalty to the Tsar. This was the most audacious of Peter's reforms. Previously, high-ranking state positions were hereditary, but with the establishment of the Table of Ranks, anyone, including a commoner, could work their way up the bureaucratic hierarchy with sufficient hard work and skill. A new generation of technocrats soon supplanted the old boyar class and dominated the civil service in Russia. With minimal modifications, the Table of Ranks remained in effect until the Russian Revolution 1917.
Are you saying we have a meritocracy? I mean, it sounds like a meritocracy. A little bit.
Yeah. Like, in the end, though, it sounds like a good idea, but again, like, corruption is always there. And who has access, who has money, who knows?
There's always going to be favors and, you know, this is my cousin, can you help him out, and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But on paper,
it sounds really cool.
It sounds great.
Again, like, how did he do it? He did it for autocracy, right?
Yeah, sort of a catch-22 there.
Exactly. You and I often talk about how two seemingly like opposite things can both be true simultaneously. The Russian political system really went and tests that really hardcore.
I mean, yeah, it's kind of like Anakin Skywalker being like, someone should make the Senate agree.
And I'm like,
he's like, that's the opposite of democracy, Anakin.
Now, when Peter died, Russia had made several massive strides in its westernization and becoming a naval power in the Baltic. There was also further land acquisition in the east at that point. Acquisition. Things are going pretty good, except for succession. Peter and his wife, Catherine, had 12 children, and only two survived to adulthood. Brief caveat, if you ever want to read about a completely wild life story, you should read about Catherine.
All right.
And she was also his second wife. That'll be important in a moment. And here's where we finally go and get to the Russian succession clown car.
Okay, okay.
Peter I was succeeded by his wife, Catherine.
Oh.
So basically, she was going to be the regent because he did not have a living heir at that point.
Oh, dear.
So everything was a complete crisis. She was mostly being controlled by her ministers at that point, and she only reigned for just over 2 years. She was succeeded by Peter II, who was the grandson of Peter I via the murdered Tsarevich Alexei, and he was the last of the direct male Romanov line. Now, you might be thinking, who is this murdered Alexei guy? Peter the Great had his first wife. They had a son named Alexei. Alexei and his mom did not like Peter. Alexei was, I'm leaving, and I'm going to go and renounce everything. I don't want to be your heir or anything. Alexei is captured, brought back to Russia, where he's then interrogated aggressively, and then dies.
Didn't mean to do that one.
Exactly.
Oop.
Yeah. There's even a famous painting of Peter the Great interrogating him.
Isn't this what happened with Ivan the Terrible too, and why the Romanovs ended up taking over? Because Ivan also got pissed at his son Alexei and killed him, and then was like, oopadoodle, yeah. I don't have an heir. Listen, I understand having issues with your children, mm-hmm. but you can't kill them.
No.
Especially if they're your heir.
Exactly. Peter II assumes the throne, and he only lasts for 3 years.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. He's then succeeded by Anna, who's daughter of Ivan the Fifth. When Peter the Great came to the throne, there actually were like two other co-rulers with him, and Ivan the Fifth was, it was his mom and like his uncle Ivan, I'm pretty sure it was his uncle, Ivan the Fifth. Ivan the Fifth died a couple years after Peter's mom did, and that's when Peter assumed like the throne fully, so she's his daughter.
Okay.
She lasts for 10 years. Okay. So we get into the double digits. So that rides us out from 1730 to 1740. She's then followed by Ivan the Sixth, who is a great-grandson of Ivan the Fifth. He's supposed as a baby, imprisoned, and later murdered. He lasted for about a year. He was born on August the 23rd, 1740, and was made emperor, czar, on the 20th of October, 1740. Jeez, I wonder why this didn't work out.
Leave babies alone.
Who replaced him? Elizabeth. Daughter of Peter I and Catherine I, and of course she usurped the throne. She was on the throne from the 6th of December, 1741 to the 5th of January, 1762. And as we know, she was succeeded by Peter III, who was the grandson of Peter I, and he was the nephew of Elizabeth. And then he was succeeded by Catherine II, also known as Catherine the Great.
What a crazy Mickey Mouse way to get to her.
I know. It is very crazy Mickey Mouse way. It kind of low-key gets worse after her. We're going to save that for later. It's a complete barrel of yikes.
Yeah, I don't even know. Who's who in the zoo and how are you in charge now?
Pretty much. The rulers preceding Catherine had mostly kept to Peter's grand vision for Russia, but Catherine was the one who really was wanting to actively realize it. And at this point, this is where we get into the other main influence in her life. The Enlightenment. How would you define the Enlightenment in a couple of sentences? I struggled for like 2 hours.
Oh man, it's really difficult. You know what? We should just insert the clip from me in our Christina episode talking about the Enlightenment.
Do that. Yeah. Actually.
Okay. Right here. The Enlightenment. So Europe in the 1600s was a period of contrast. It was a violent century filled with wars and revolutions. The most terrible conflict, the Thirty Years' War, involved most European nations and devastated the German states where most of the fighting took place. At the same time, discoveries of scientists and achievements of artists made it a golden age. So we have Louis XIV in France. He eventually builds Versailles. Newton, Kepler, Harvey, they're making scientific discoveries in the West. Probably out east, they've had this for hundreds of centuries, but, you know, we finally catch up.
Yep.
and they established valid methods of scientific inquiry. New ideas of reason were being circulated. René Descartes, I think, therefore I am, mm-hmm. argued that only ideas that could be proved by evidence or reasoning were true. This period saw the beginnings of religious toleration in Protestant countries of Europe, but only after considerable bloodshed.
Hopefully I talked about it correctly, but I'm pretty sure I did.
You know what? It's fine. If you got concerned, you know, just, it's fine.
Arts and sciences, y'all. Arts and science.
Yeah. There are two threads with Peter's goals, is that he wanted to, yes, modernize Russia, but he also wanted to transform Russia into a superpower. We want to be, like, new on the inside, but we want everyone to know on the outside how we're doing, you know?
Well, and I think creating a city like St. Petersburg is a great way to showcase that.
Oh, yeah. So, like, again, like, he started the process and Catherine wanted to realize it. So we're going to talk a little bit about the foreign policy and the external politics, and then we're going to go a little bit more inwards.
Mm-hmm.
During her reign, Catherine extended by some 520,000 square kilometers, 200,000 square miles, the borders of the Russian Empire, absorbing New Russia, Crimea, Northern Caucasus, right bank Ukraine, Belarus, Lithuania, and Courland at the expense mainly of two powers, the Ottoman Empire and the Polish-Lithuania Commonwealth. Catherine's foreign minister, Nikita Panin, who was in office from 1763 to 1781, exercised considerable influence from the beginning of her reign. A shrewd statesman, Panin dedicated much effort and millions of rubles to setting up a northern accord between Russia, Prussia, Poland, and Sweden to counter the power of the Bourbon-Habsburg League. Marie Theresa, we're getting to Marie Antoinette times. These, like, the Holy Roman Empire in Austria. Marie Theresa's like, I got my clown car vagina of all my kids. Yeah. I gotta be marrying
I'm taking over the world slowly but surely with lots of marriages.
Exactly. And she had managed to go and secure the French, which was a real coup at the time. When it became apparent that his plan could not succeed, Panin fell out of favor and Catherine had him replaced with Ivan Osterman in 1781, and he lasted for about 16 years or so. Catherine agreed to a commercial treaty with Great Britain in 1766, but stopped short of a full military alliance. Although she could see the benefit of Britain's friendship, she was wary of Britain's increased power following its complete victory in the Seven Years' War, which threatened the European balance of power.
Yes, it did.
Mm-hmm.
And I only know it from the Canadian side.
Exactly. Peter the Great had succeeded in gaining a toehold in the south, on the edge of the Black Sea, and the Azov campaigns. Catherine completed the conquest of the south, making Russia the dominant power in southeastern Europe after the Russo-Turkish War of 1768 to 1774. Russia inflicted some of the heaviest defeats ever suffered by the Ottoman Empire, including the Battle of Chesma and the Battle of Kagul. In 1769, a last major Crimean Nogai slave raid, which ravaged the Russian-held territories in Ukraine, saw the capture of 20,000 slaves.
Oof.
Yep. The Russian victories procured access to the Black Sea and allowed Catherine's government to incorporate present-day southern Ukraine, where the Russians founded the new cities of Odessa, Nikolaev, Yekaterinoslav, literally the glory of Catherine, the future Dniprov, and Kherson. The Treaty of Kukuk, Kanarka, signed on the 10th of July, 1774, gave the Russians territories at Azov, Kerch, Yenikal, Kinburn, and the small strip of the Black Sea coast between the rivers Dnieper and Bug. The treaty also removed restrictions on Russian naval or commercial traffic in the Azov Sea, granted to Russia the position of protector of the Orthodox Christians in the Ottoman Empire, and made the Crimea a protectorate of Russia. Russia's State Council in 1770 announced a policy in favor of eventual Crimean independence. Catherine named Sahin Grey, a Crimean Tartar leader, to the head of the Crimean state and maintained friendly relations with Russia. His period of rule proved disappointing after repeated efforts to prop up his regime through military force and monetary aid. Finally, Catherine annexed the Crimea in 1783. The palace of the Crimean Khanate passed into the hands of the Russians. In 1787, Catherine conducted a triumphal progression in the Crimea, which helped provoke the next Russo-Turkish War. And that war ended poorly for the Ottomans and legitimized the Russian claim to the Crimea and granted the Yedistan region to Russia, which is basically the southern regions of Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
Again, like, because they had the Black Sea, they now had naval access and ship access north and south,
yeah.
Which is huge.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, because she gained significant diplomatic power in the early 1770s, Catherine considered something called the Greek Project. This consisted of pushing the Turks out of Europe, reclaiming Constantinople from Muslims to Orthodox Christian life. The Second Turkish War of 1787 to 1792 ended with Russia gaining the fortress of Ochakov and the Black Sea shore of the Dniester River, and the Ottoman Empire recognizing Russia's annexation of Crimea. But it was always a continual back and forth of that area. Mm-hmm. There's a reason why people are always pushing about Ukraine, because it was known as the breadbasket for a reason.
Yeah. Well, and then also, it is this place that's been sort of contested back and forth, and the lines keep getting redrawn again and again.
Yep.
Russia's still illegally invaded Ukraine.
I do remember that.
I think they're still there.
They are still there. They're probably going to go and invade all of Ukraine and overtake it in like the next 3 or 4 years.
So we don't talk about that.
We never talk about that.
Interesting.
Retaking Constantinople and creating a Christian empire centered there does not appear to be a very enlightened plan or very enlightenment-based.
Well, you got to get the people on your side, right? So
yeah. And
what better than a 1700s crusade?
Yeah. But the thing is, though, Catherine saw land grabbing as an easy way to assert Russia's intentions, fundamentally.
I have to take you over so then I can make you enlightened.
Exactly. By declaring that Constantinople would only...
I'm going to war for democracy.
Exactly. By declaring that Constantinople would one day belong to Christians, she also appeased the church, which still had significant influence in the 18th century. She wished to show the Western powers that her country would be as a powerful presence in European political matters as theirs. Catherine's partition of Poland was an even more blatant example of power politics. Russia invaded 3 separate times in 1772, 1793, and 1795, and divided the once important European state between itself, Austria, and Prussia. The 3rd of May Constitution of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, voted in 1791, was considered by Catherine as a Jacobin threat and was therefore presenting a threat to Russian monarchy and its influence in Poland, which ultimately led to a military expedition resulting in the destruction of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. You know that we had to go and talk about Poland at one point.
I mean, yeah, just a little bit.
Just a little bit.
In her opinion, she's probably like, I just want to go back to my home. So the best way to get back home is just to take over all the area between me and my home.
Exactly. What do you mean you're all Catholic? Don't you, like, want to give that up? Oh.
I mean, I give up my religion.
Why can't you? No, obviously, like, way more happened during her reign. There were trade negotiations with the Chinese, attempts to talk to the Japanese shogunate.
And they were like, no.
No, pretty much. There were more wars. There were so many wars. But Catherine paradoxically also wanted to present Russia as a mediator between the powers. I'll go and I'll kick your ass, but the big people's table, she's a nice person.
Yeah, she's like, let's all get along, everybody, now that I've all punched you into submission.
Exactly. In 1780, she established a League of Armed Neutrality, designed to defend neutral shipping from British Royal Navy during the American Revolution. After establishing a League of Neutral Parties, Catherine the Great attempted to act as a mediator between the United States and Britain by submitting a ceasefire plan.
That is kind of cool.
Well, and also because, like, she's not stupid. She has this trade agreement with the States, but because most of their shit at this point is still coming from America, everybody's blockading each other. Fam, I need my shit. You need to stop.
Stop fighting, guys. I need my things.
Exactly. So that's, like, her foreign policy in broad strokes. So you can go and see the whole, we're going to be a great power externally, offensively. That was the goal.
We're a mover and we're a shaker. Because it's one thing if you're a big European power punching down on, you know, the Ottoman Empire.
Even though the Ottoman Empire is absolutely massive.
It's massive and it's actually a force to be reckoned with. But we're talking about, like, you know, a bunch of crusty white people. Oh, we can take them. And that was sort of Russia's problem in the future when with Japan being like, well, we can take them. And then they couldn't. Mm-hmm. So I feel like then she was just, okay, next level. Now I'm going to fight my own peeps. I'm going to punch out these whitey Polish people.
Exactly.
And she's like, aha! Yeah. And they're like, whoa! She's punching out our people!
She means business!
She means business!
Exactly.
She's like, I'm getting a seat at this goddamn table.
Exactly. Move over. I'm coming through. So now we kind of turn to her internal policies. One of her big projects was, well, building projects. Her building program was extensive. She commissioned hundreds of new public buildings. There were orphanages, there were schools, there were hospitals, there were banks, theaters, libraries, universities. The list goes on. You get an orphanage, you get a hospital, you get a university, you get, you know, like on a plan.
Mm-hmm.
St. Petersburg, which was the Romanovs' new capital. Because remember, Moscow is the traditional capital of Russia. But Peter was the one who said, I'm going to make a new capital, fresh start. It's going to be on the water. Moscow was on a river, but it was a minor river. It wasn't like it was on like the Volga.
No.
St. Petersburg is on the Volga and it empties out into the Baltic.
It's a gateway place. That's why.
London's on the Thames. Stockholm is the Venice of the North and it's built on like the archipelago. You have the Dutch. They're basically building out across the sea. Anybody who was a significant naval power at that point, you needed to go and have your great port city. It's your first impression, fundamentally. St. Petersburg was more thoroughly realized during her reign. She commissioned buildings for the Academy of Sciences, the Stock Exchange, the Imperial Academy of the Arts, several universities, an orphanage which had its own theater, a public library, a public theater, palaces, and so many more public buildings. Obviously, there is a little bit is a vanity project. Instead of just like, these are all places where I can live.
Yeah, and things for me it's and like, my pals.
For Catherine, she had a bigger project in mind, and she needed these spaces to achieve that project. And since the capital was a watery city built on a swamp, it had 93 rivers and several canals. She also commissioned several engineering works. There were new canals, reinforcing the banks of the existing canals with stone, deepening of the river's beds, built up embankments, erected stone bridges to replace the wooden ones. She took the city into the 18th century. Moscow was not neglected. It also got many more projects. The University of Moscow was built. The Senate got a new building. There was another orphanage. There was a state bank. And there was also a proto shopping mall that was built, too.
Yes, she did.
Mm-hmm. She founded more than 100 new towns and cities. She renovated the existing ones that were there. But I like our town hall. Bulldoze it all.
Makeover.
Yeah. Catherine favored the neoclassical style in architecture. Basically, she went and she got the best Italian architects to realize her vision. A nice note is that for health reasons, she also banned cemeteries within the city, slaughterhouses, polluting factories, and animal markets from within the interior core. She also established places for trash disposal and declared it illegal to pollute the waterways.
An environmentalist before we knew which one was.
Go, Catherine. In terms of administration within the interior, she established 50 gubernii provinces divided into 10 districts. 300,000 to 400,000 people lived in each province, and 20,000 to 30,000 lived in every district. A governor and a network of officials divided by executive, legislative, and judicial functions were ideally supposed to run each province. Catherine also wanted the gentry to play a role in local political affairs, instead of just going sitting on their asses doing nothing or killing serfs. Catherine's political reforms went beyond perfecting Russia's bureaucracy. Her nakaz, or instruction, expressed her political ideals. She wrote this text for her legislative commission summoned in 1767 to draft a code of laws for Russia. But what was this document fully? Now, it was a statement of legal principles that was written solely by her, permeated with the ideals of the French Enlightenment. It was compiled as a guide for the All-Russian Legislative Commission, and it was supposed to go and be replacing the 17th century Muscovite code of laws with a more contemporary law code. Catherine believed that to strengthen law and institutions was, above all else, a way to strengthen the monarchy. The instruction proclaimed the equality of all men before the law and disapproved of the death penalty and torture. thus anticipating some of the issues raised by the later United States Constitution and the Polish Constitution. Although the ideas of absolutism were emphatically upheld, the stance towards serfdom is more blurry. Cavern worked in the instruction for 2 years. In 1766, she showed the manuscript to her closest advisors, her foreign affairs minister, Nikita Panin, and her general, Grigory Orlov, aka the guy who helped her with the coup.
Aka the guy that Nicholas Hoult should have played.
Yeah. Asking them to make the changes as they thought necessary. In its final version, the instruction consists of 22 chapters and 655 articles, which embrace various spheres of state, criminal, and civil law and procedure. Representatives from all free estates of the realm, government bodies, and non-Russian people considered the state of Russian laws. Several of her advisors suggested putting in a place for a council to regulate legislation, but she promptly rejected it. Once Catherine began to lose the slightest amount of power, she reverted to the ways of the past, autocratic rule. She ruled through a series of functional colleges headed by boards under the presidents who worked in cooperation with the appointed administrative senate of 20 to 30 people. The senate possessed no legislative powers. Catherine kept the power to pass laws, fundamentally.
So, like, this is why change doesn't happen fast when you have a micromanager.
Some argue that Catherine used the Enlightenment as a way of placing, quote, her rule in firm philosophic foundations and providing a national guide for the moral leadership of Europe. Others say she used her laws for purely practical reasons. She established a civil law code in January 1774 and a criminal code during the second half of the 1770s, but never finished a unitary code. She drew heavily in the nakaz from the latest continental jurisprudence, but ignored references to natural law. For anybody who's like, what's the difference between natural law? We have the right to certain freedoms. We have the right to be free from torture, all that type of stuff. Then you go and you have criminal law, insert whatever type of law that regulate our understanding of the natural law.
Naturally, well, we shouldn't torture one another, but politically, but what is torture anyways?
Pretty much. What is our basis for, like, human conduct?
We live in a society.
As Rousseau taught us. We all
as George Costanza.
You know what? Because, you know, we do live in...
we do live in a society.
We live in a society, and we all give up certain rights and privileges so that the society can go and function for the betterment of the whole collective.
Yes.
Individual rights and freedoms. Now, you might be thinking, wow, look at this woman with all of her accomplishments. And clearly, she does care about equality. She might be a micromanager. Yeah, I guess, sort of, but not really if you're a serf.
Oh, the serf question. Serfs are essentially peasants from the medieval times, which means you are essentially a slave because you are tied to the land and the land is not yours, but you have to toil away until you die.
And your children are born indentured too, and your chances of not being indentured are slim to none.
I think the only way you get free from being a serf is if your landowner kills you.
Pretty much. Yeah.
And this is the great serf question, which Russia struggled with for many, many centuries.
Many, many, many centuries. So Catherine's instruction actually argued initially for the abolition of serfdom. Her stance initially was very unpopular, and the Russian nobility were like, we are not emancipating our serfs. We're not emancipating our free labor. I just want to, I want to kill somebody without repercussions. Is well, it that also, hard like, to ask?
One day, I just tell him to do the stuff, and the next day you're telling me I have to pay him to do the stuff? Where am I supposed to get that money? From my own bank account?
Exactly. She essentially felt that she was forced to drop the idea at that point early on because she needed to go and have the noble support. Like, she hadn't established her power at that point.
This is something that does come up in The Great, actually. Mm-hmm. But they kind of show it to be that BS thing of, if we don't force workers to work, then they'll just be lazy and do nothing. And I'm like that's not true.
And also, like, that wasn't the philosophy or the impetus at that point. Like, they didn't care about people being layabouts. They cared about having free labor.
Yes.
Yeah.
But we don't get into that because it's too complicated for a modern audience.
Yeah. But she did continue her husband's idea of, let's outlaw the right to murder a serf. And owners also started to face heavy fines and punishments if they were unusually cruel to their serfs. And she also granted serfs the right to advocate for themselves within courthouses. Because before, if you were a serf and you wanted to go and, like, get any sort of thing, you had to go to the capital. Your chances of going to the freaking capital of your surf out in the middle of, like, the ass crack of nowhere. Yeah.
The time, the money, just everything.
The right to actually leave the land that you're bound to.
You're like, hi, I need to go to court so I can press charges against you, my owner. What? You can't take me to court. You're a chair.
Yeah, exactly. You are an object. She had ideas. She wanted to do more, but she felt restricted. This all went to shit when Yemelyan Pugachev showed up.
Ah.
So, I got a hint of familiarity. Do you remember him?
I think this guy claims to be her dead husband.
Yeah, so Pugachev, basically, he claimed to be Peter the Third, was not Peter the Third. He was a serf, and he led a rebellion against Catherine, and basically was actually able to go and get a significant amount of support, and they basically went around burning down towns and cities at points.
This is what happens when you're pandering too much to the noble contingent and not thinking enough about the serf contingent.
Exactly. And so, of course, his rebellion was crushed. That basically left serfs worse off under Catherine, fundamentally.
Yeah,
because why would she go and want to help these people if they were going to be a threat to her rule? Because she is fundamentally an autocrat.
Yes.
For all of her ideals,
at the end of the day,
we can be enlightened as long as it's exactly where I want it to go.
Yeah, and as long as I'm still in charge.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So nothing changed. The Russian gentry and the nobility continued to benefit from her westernizing economics, which increased her purchasing power, and the imperial coffers increased because of the increased labor from the serfs, because what's the best way to go and crush people but to go and work them to death even faster?
Well, now they don't have to just work in a field. We have all these new factories
that they can work in, too. Tired of owning land, tired of being out in the middle of nowhere, go to a massive city, open up a factory. You can bring your serfs with you. They'll love it. See them? They're only chained at their ankles and not at their wrists. Let me go. No, just stay there, Ivan. You love it. No, I don't. I've been sitting for 20 years. That's pretty much what ended up happening.
Yeah.
Yeah. Serfs exploiting their labor further, but also the secularization and the seizing of church assets.
Ah, yes. The other way to make money.
Remember how she was all like, hey, church, I'm like my husband. I respect you. Of course, that was all a lie, but...
She's like, I respect you.
I respect your money and my wallet.
Church, you got a lot of gold going on there. I think that gold should be my gold.
Exactly. All that land should be Russia's land, but it'd be completely under your control. I am Russia.
Basically, it's free real estate.
Exactly. But this kind of then goes like, so we've talked about her foreign policy. We've talked about some of her economics and her administrative policies. So now we're going to go and get into maybe the only area that she wholeheartedly succeeded in, which is arts and culture. So she's considered to be the only articulate ideologist to rule Russia between Ivan IV and Lenin. I freaking love that quote. Catherine only wanted to have military and political equality within Western European countries, but she also strove to emulate their enlightened rule by supplanting Western thought and practices onto the Russian gentry. Catherine did this because of the universal standards that Europeans used compared to themselves. It became a way to go and establish the own ideology which she wanted to promote and which would go and maintain her control. Basically, if I educate them in the way that I want them to think,
then yeah, they'll get in line.
Yeah. In contrast to Peter the Great, who regulated Russian society through public ceremony and legislation, Catherine promoted, quote, the internal mechanisms of behavior regulation, end quote. She attempted to achieve this remarkable goal for education. Russia set up state-run schools that provided students with learning in the free arts, so reading, writing, and arithmetic, as well as about behavior that was considered proper for citizenship. Schools stressed two principles above all else, the need to be patriotic and the need to accept innovation. Catherine's Smolny Institute in St. Petersburg, which is based on the French Maison Royale de Saint-Louis, taught upper-class girls polite manners in society and gave them a moral education. Girls studied not only dance, music, sewing, drawing, and household economy, but also law, mathematics, languages, geography, history, economy, architecture, science, and ethics. Pretty much, she wanted to go and give to other Russian noble girls the education that she had to go and get herself.
Yeah, like, that she wouldn't have gotten if she didn't become empress.
Pretty much. Her subcommission on education concerned itself not with the sciences, but with primary, secondary, and higher education. The idea was to teach children the duties required of those who live in society. The subcommission began its work in May 1768 and used the English universities, the Prussian system of national education, and quote-unquote Irish schools as models. The state then established free co-educational high schools and primary schools in provincial towns in 1786. By 1764, district towns received primary schools. However, rural schools did not come into existence. Few children attended public schools. Around 176,000 children passed through Russian public schools between 1786 and 1796. Russia lacked the finances and the teachers to run these schools properly.
Chicken egg.
Exactly.
If you build it, they may or may not be able to come.
Look at your beautiful schoolhouse. We don't have enough teachers.
We don't have teachers. We don't have supplies. And also, we have a lot of work to do.
That's another thing. Obviously, child labor freaking sucks. We're not suggesting that at all. However, at that time, if you worked on a farm, you needed all hands on deck. Most of those children, they could not go beyond the family land. And even if they weren't serfs, if there was not the economy or the need to.
Well, because, like, what would an education get you besides personal and self-edification? It's not like you do it so you can get a better job or something.
Because there is no better job in your surrounding area. You're going to become a farmer like your dad.
Yeah.
And that's a good life, too.
It's not really thinking about the context in which the school is being built.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But her real triumph, though, was fundamentally in the arts. Catherine was a passionate patron of the arts, especially theater, literature, painting, and sculpture. Her art collection became the basis of the Hermitage Museum and the Winter Palace in St. Petersburg, which is arguably one of the most impressive collections in the world. If you looked at every single piece for not even, I think, like a second, it would still take you like 4 or 5 days to get through it all. That's how much is in there.
It's like, how'd you spend your entire 3 weeks? Just going in the Hermitage.
Yep. Her collections included works by Rembrandt, Franz Hals, Rubens, Titian, Raphael, Van Dyck, Elizabeth Vigée Le Brun.
Marie Antoinette's portraiture.
Exactly. She was a glutton for art. That's what she described herself as.
Love it.
But she also used European paintings and European-inspired buildings to proclaim Russia to be part of the modern westernized world. Look at us. We're doing it like you. So this kind of leads to, but how does this all end? Though Catherine's life and reign included remarkable personal successes, her life ended in arguably two major failures. Her Swedish cousin, once removed, was King Gustav Adolf IV of Sweden, and he visited her in September 1796. And her intention was that her granddaughter, Alexandra, should become queen of Sweden by marriage. And a ball was thrown, and everything was going great. Gustav Adolf felt pressure to accept that Alexandra would not convert to Lutheranism. And although he really liked her, he refused to appear at the ball and he headed back for Stockholm. The frustration affected Catherine's health. She recovered well enough to begin to plan a ceremony which would establish her favorite grandson, Alexander, as her heir, superseding her difficult son, Paul. But she died before the announcement could be made, just over 2 months after that failed engagement ball. Catherine and Paul were never close.
No, but because he was taken away from her when he was a baby, I think that played a huge role. And there's like that whole thing with the parent not actually being able to raise their own kid and the kid being raised by whoever's sitting on the throne, aka the grandparent. Cece's kids were taken
from her
and raised by Franz's mom.
Sophie, and her relationship with her oldest daughter and her son were never really great.
Yeah, they were very detached because she wasn't allowed to be a mom to them.
Yeah, and the only reason why she was so obsessed of her son, quote unquote, like, loved him so much is because he was her ticket out.
Yeah.
So it was never a good relationship. As we can see, there is a precedent. I don't want my bio kid.
Whatever, we're just skipping over people. It doesn't matter.
But she couldn't go and make those plans finalized.
She should have written it down on a napkin.
I know, man. On the 16th of November, 1796, Catherine rose early in the morning and had her usual morning coffee and soon settled down to work on papers. She went and she told her lady's maid that she had slept better than she had in a long time. Sometime after 9 o'clock in the morning. She was found on the floor of her face purplish, her pulse was weak, and her breathing was shallowed and quite labored.
Oh, dear.
The court physician diagnosed a stroke, and despite attempts to revive her, she fell into a coma. She was given the last rites and died the following evening around 9:45. An autopsy confirmed that the stroke was indeed the cause of death. And upon her death, she was succeeded by her son, Paul, who then proceeded to try and undo every single thing she did.
Of course, because, you know, that's how I'll show myself different than Mom.
And then he also was mysteriously killed, like his dad.
Oh, no.
And then Alexander, the preferred grandson, was, I'm gonna just slide right in here. And it was this back and forth between people who were reactionaries, like Paul, and then you have the reformers, like Alexander, and then you have Nicholas the First, who was a dick, and then you have Alexander the Second, who was kind of cool, but then he got killed no matter what. The final penultimate question, I think, for us is, was she great?
I would say so, just because of, I think you could look at any number of reasons, from a rags to riches type of story, that's great. From a woman in a man's world, that's great. Expanding the Russian Empire to its greatest peak, you know, if you're a warmonger, I'm sure you're like, that's pretty great.
If you're really into arts and culture, look at that Hermitage Museum.
I think, though, it seems to swing back and forth between reactionary and reforming and making change, but then not too much change. She reigned long enough that she did that
within her own reign
enough times that it's really hard to land on, okay, she was a good reformer and she wanted amazing progressive stuff. But at
the same time, she wrote all these amazing ideas. She freaking taught herself law, you know?
And opened schools. But on the flip side, what are we going to do about serfs? And I'm pretty sure she was the one where if she would go on tour, they would hide the really sad, starving looking people and bring out better looking actors who are dressed as happy, smiley peasants. And she's like, see, my people are happy. Now, whether or not that was at her express command or it was the people around who were like, let's keep her in a good mood and have this happen. The fact that that needed to happen
says something.
Says that there's a big problem. Like something is rotten in the state of not Denmark, but Russia.
Yeah.
So I think that's where I'm landing on it. I mean, I don't ever want to just hashtag girl boss all over something and therefore not say, okay, but we got some work to do.
For me, is that when you think about the great doesn't have to mean good.
No.
That's the nuance that can be really difficult for people to always remember, is that greatness doesn't inherently mean that somebody is good. Jeff Bezos is a great businessman.
Does that mean he's a good businessman
and like does good things? Not really.
It's funny how you have Ivan the Terrible. The Russian word that they are actually translating terrible from doesn't mean like scary monster man.
No.
It means like shock and awe. It resonates with you. And I feel like, to your point, when we say great, we're looking at it through our understanding and our English translation of the word great.
Even our contemporary lens, right?
Yeah, that's not necessarily what they're meaning back then. They're talking about someone who's basically like an earthquake.
Yeah.
Coming through, wreaking devastation depending on which way your house is falling, but at the same time as we're rebuilding.
Yeah.
And we're going to do better than before.
Exactly. She would tear down your entire town. You may not want her to, but I'm going to build it up better in my vision.
Yeah, and it depends on whether or not you're on board with that vision or not.
Exactly. But I do want to share this one quote, which was done by LeBron when she first visited the Empress. The sight of this famous woman so impressed me that I found it impossible to think of anything. I could only stare at her. Firstly, I was very surprised at her small stature. I'd imagined her to be very tall, as great as her fame. She was also very fat, but her face was still beautiful. She wore her white hair up, framing it perfectly. That's the thing about Catherine. Here's this small, should not be imposing, but she was going to be a force to be reckoned with regardless because she had a vision for Russia. Till Lenin, no one had as strong of conviction of this is what it means to be Russian and this is where we need to go in the future to still be Russia.
Well, it's resilience and grit.
Exactly.
And I think that's what turns you into a memorable figure of history versus who the heck is that person?
Yeah, it really is what makes you the great.
Follow us for more research, fun facts, soundtracks, and aesthetic posts. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Twitter at Royal Diaries Pod.